So we're well into this chapter, the ascent of the sacrifice, the first part. This is subtitled The Works of Knowledge and the Psychic Being. And so we begin to deal a little bit more with knowledge in this section. It might be constructive to remember the context in which Sri Aurobindo is writing. It's about 1932. The ashram is a handful of years old by now. Probably there are more than 100 people living in the ashram. What they are constructing under the leadership and guidance of Sri Aurobindo and the mother is a community which runs smoothly, which is effective, which is well organized, which is beautiful. Every visitor that came from outside was struck by the deep harmony that they felt there. Now, obviously, all these 100 people living under the leadership of Mother and Sri Aurobindo were humans, and so you can imagine that there must have been discord. In fact, we have a reading the correspondence of Sri Aurobindo, ample opportunity to see that many, many difficult situations arose in the conduct of actual life, practicing an integral yoga. So Sri Aurobindo's insistence on keeping to the core of the practice was something that he was writing here as he revised these chapters in the synthesis of yoga, but also something that he was communicating in correspondence. You might know that I think in 1932, the year that he was doing this, or was it 1933, he wrote something like 450 letters of significant size, more than one a day. The next year, he wrote, I think, 1,350. So, three to four times as many. You can imagine how he ran out of time to finish editing and revising the synthesis of yoga, because he had such voluminous correspondence to attend to, answering the here and now questions, minutely timed and termed to each person who wrote him. And people had to wait for some time to be able to get a reply from him, if ever they did. Maybe one in 10 letters he actually responded to. I don't know what the proportion is. But he was awash in correspondence. And so when we look at these chapters that he did manage to come back and treat and substantially revise, they're a precious document, but they also could be read in collaboration with the correspondence that he wrote in those years. Unfortunately, it's not so easy to pick the letters that were written in 1932 apart from the ones that were written later. But these were the years in the Sri Aurobindo ashram, which were past that most wonderful period, but still was a very fruitful period in the ashram's history. There were fewer than 150 disciples. Mother would later note that as long as there were no more than that, she could keep them all, in a sense, enfolded in her consciousness and follow their development. And many had enriching experiences, expansions into spiritual vistas. The capacity to practice the yoga and get the fruit of it was there, up until the mid-1930s. So he was writing this in 1932. So we begin at this breaking point where we left it. It is natural from the point of view of the yoga, to divide into two categories the activities of the human mind in its pursuit of knowledge. There is the supreme, supra-intellectual knowledge, which concentrates itself on the discovery of the one and infinite in its transcendence, or tries to penetrate by intuition, contemplation, direct inner contact into the ultimate truths behind the appearances of nature. There is the lower science, which diffuses itself in an outward knowledge of phenomena, the disguises of the one and infinite as it appears to us in or through the more exterior forms of the world manifestation around us. These two, an upper and a lower hemisphere, in the form of them constructed or conceived by men within the mind's ignorant limits, have even there separated themselves as they developed with some sharpness. So, the supreme supra-intellectual knowledge, essentially, that's the paravidya of the Vedanta. And the lower sciences, which diffuses outwardly into the knowledge of nature, you might say, that's the aparavidya, both of which are spoken about in the Mundaka Upanishad, one of the primary texts upon which a world-embracing Vedanta, as established by the ancient seers, was promoted. Mundaka has been translated often as, you know, the Upanishad of the shaven head. People like to think of it as the Upanishad that leans towards renunciation, but then you look at its pages and it extols the beauty of Brahman, who is everywhere manifest in all the magnificent universe, and also says in this section where you find this reference, that would be in the first big break, the first chapter, verses 3 through 7, that like the spider putting forth its threads as the herbs grow from the earth, etc., as the hairs grow from a person's head, so all of this grows out of the Aksharat, the imperishable, that one without a name, that absolute, that unknowable, that transcendence expresses itself in the wonders of the universe. And to know that is the higher knowledge, paravidya. To know the rest of it is important too, but it's aparavidya. It's not the most important thing, so get to that first. That's the advice. That doesn't require a renunciation of the world, but it requires that we have our proper orientation towards our task. If we're going to practice the yoga, an integral yoga too, we must aim at the realization and then go from the realization into the fulfillment outward in the world. This is why Sri Aurobindo notes that he begins with a Vedantic basis and moves towards a tantric synthesis. The tantra looks to bring everything into the orbit because sees the divine as a manifestation of the divine mother and must be incorporated. So, paravidya and aparavidya, and then let us see what the ordinary human mind and the development of its culture comes up with to approach this supreme reality. First, philosophy. Philosophy, sometimes spiritual or at least intuitive, sometimes abstract and intellectual, sometimes intellectualizing spiritual experience or supporting with a logical apparatus the discoveries of the spirit, has claimed always to take the fixation of ultimate truth as its province. But even when it did not separate itself on rarefied metaphysical heights from the knowledge that belongs to the practical world and the pursuit of ephemeral objects, intellectual philosophy, by its habit of abstraction, has seldom been a power for life. So if its goal is the absolute, it's lost the practicum. It has been sometimes powerful for high speculation, pursuing mental truth for its own sake, without any ulterior utility or object, sometimes for a subtle gymnastic of the mind in a mistily bright cloudland of words and ideas, but it has walked or acrobatized far from the more tangible realities of existence. Ancient philosophy in Europe was more dynamic, but only for the few. In India, in its more spiritualized forms, it strongly influenced but without transforming the life of the race. Religion did not attempt, like philosophy, to live alone on the heights. Its aim was rather to take hold of man's parts of life even more than his parts of mind and draw them Godwards. It professed to build a bridge between spiritual truth and the vital and material human existence. It strove to subordinate and reconcile the lower to the higher, make life serviceable to God, earth obedient to heaven. It has to be admitted that too often this necessary effort had the opposite result of making heaven a sanction for earth's desires. For continually, the religious idea has been turned into an excuse for the worship and service of the human ego. Religion, leaving constantly its little shining core of spiritual experience, has lost itself in the obscure mass of its ever-extending ambiguous compromises with life. In attempting to satisfy the thinking mind, it more often succeeded in oppressing or fettering it with a mass of theological dogmas. While seeking to net the human heart, it fell itself into pits of pietistic emotionalism and sensationalism. In the act of annexing the vital nature of man to dominate it, it grew itself vitiated and fell a prey to all the fanaticism, homicidal fury, savage or harsh turn for oppression, pullulating falsehood, obstinate attachment to ignorance to which that vital nature is prone. Its desire to draw the physical in man towards God betrayed it into chaining itself to ecclesiastic mechanism, hollow ceremony, and lifeless ritual. The corruption of the best produced the worst by that strange chemistry of the power of life which generates evil out of good, even as it can also generate good out of evil. At the same time, in a vain self-effort at self-defense against this downward gravitation, religion was driven to cut existence into two by a division of knowledge, works, art, life itself, into two opposite categories, the spiritual and the worldly, religious and mundane, sacred and profane. But this defensive distinction itself became conventional and artificial, and aggravated rather than healed the disease. Well, there's a great deal there in religious and cultural history, and I let you fill in the blanks yourself. But as Shri Aurobindo has written elsewhere, you know, the core of religion, what gives it its impetus, is a deep experience of reality, just as the core of philosophy is the deep perception of a truth. To Sri Aurobindo, The most genuine kind of knowledge is knowledge by identity. You must enter into oneness with that thing. The subject and the object, the I and the thou, must become the same reality. So this is not the numinous experience of the Supreme, where that is so great and I am so small and I recognize you and your exalted splendor, but rather the union of the drop with the ocean, of the ray going back into the sun from which it came, the microcosm, one with the macrocosm, both proceeding from the immensity and the inexplicable nature of that which is beyond nature. So, the exoteric business of religion draws our attention to the ritual, and the ritual which should be there to enliven and give form to the spirit as it wishes to express itself becomes a prison in which the experience has then to sit, and it is uncomfortable. Worse, the conflict among the different faiths. You remember that Vaishnavism and Shaivism, the worship of Vishnu and Shiva, begins to come rather late, long, long after the Vedic age, long, long after the Upanishadic age. And it is only with the conflict of these various paths that we begin to see religious bloodshed in India. Of course, we see it in Europe when Christianity faces down Islam, when the pagan religions of Rome try to suppress Christianity, etc., etc. There's plenty of room for humans to act against the perceived other throughout our history. But it takes religious form. Only as we begin to ossify our perception of truth into well-regulated dogmas and icons from which there can be no variance. Remember, Sri Aurobindo aims at an integrality that's based on an essential experience of a reality that expresses itself in innumerable forms. He establishes a yoga which permits every kind of approach to the divine, whether through our opening consciousness, through our opening heart, or our opening will to allow that energy to express itself through us, or all at once. So, never imprisoned in any form or any ritual that becomes dead. Now he turns to science and art. On their side, science and art and the knowledge of life, although at first they served or lived in the shadow of religion, ended by emancipating themselves, became estranged or hostile, or have even recoiled with indifference, contempt, or skepticism from what seem to them the cold, barren, and distant or unsubstantial and illusory heights of unreality to which metaphysical philosophy and religion aspire. For a time, the divorce has been as complete as the one-sided intolerance of the human mind could make it, and threatened even to end in a complete extinction of all attempt at a higher or a more spiritual knowledge. Yet, even in the earthward life, a higher knowledge is indeed the one thing that is throughout needful. And without it, the lower sciences and pursuits, however fruitful, however rich, free, miraculous in the abundance of their results, become easily a sacrifice offered without due order and to false gods, corrupting, hardening in the end the heart of man, limiting his mind's horizons. They confine in a stony material imprisonment, or lead to a final baffling incertitude and disillusionment. A sterile agnosticism awaits us above the brilliant phosphorescence of a half-knowledge that is still the ignorance. So what we deem in the human field to be knowledge is still to the sage an ignorance, a brighter than ordinary ignorance, but an ignorance nevertheless. A yoga turned towards an all-embracing realization of the Supreme will not despise the works or even the dreams, if dreams they are, of the cosmic spirit, or shrink from the splendid toil and many-sided victory which he has assigned to himself and the human creature. But its first condition for this liberality is that our works in the world, too, must be part of the sacrifice offered to the highest and to none else, to the divine Shakti and to no other power. In the right spirit and with the right knowledge, by the free soul and not by the hypnotized bond slave of material nature. If a division of works has to be made, it is between those that are nearest to the heart of the sacred flame and those that are least touched or illumined by it because they are more at a distance. Or between the fuel that burns strongly and brightly and the logs that, if too thickly heaped on the altar, may impede the ardor of the fire by their rather damp, heavy, and diffused abundance. Now, this calls forward the idea in India of who's ready to practice the yoga. And obviously, the person who is on fire is alive with the experience of the divine. And around him are other logs. Those nearest and driest catch fire and they begin to burn too. But even those which are wet or damp, a little further away, because of the warmth of the blaze, begin to get dry. So all are brought closer and closer into the orbit in an aspirational community. There must be the realization at the center. Others must be building towards that same experience, to live in that same oneness. But it's perfectly fine if not everybody has realized at the beginning. The closer they get, the drier the log will become, the more ready to be inflamed with the ardor of ascent, the ascent of the sacrifice. But otherwise, he continues, apart from this division, all activities of knowledge that seek after or express truth are in themselves rightful materials for a complete offering. None ought necessarily to be excluded from the wide framework of the divine life. The mental and physical sciences, which examine into the laws and forms and processes of things, those which concern the life of men and animals, the social, political, linguistic, and historical, and those which seek to know and control the labors and activities by which man subdues and utilizes his world and environment, and the noble and beautiful arts, which are at once work and knowledge, For every well-made and significant poem, picture, statue, or building is an act of creative knowledge, a living discovery of the consciousness, a figure of truth, a dynamic form of mental and vital self-expression or world expression. All that seeks, all that finds, all that voices or figures is a realization of something of the play of the infinite, and to that extent can be made a means of God realization or of divine formation. But the yogin has to see that it is no longer done as part of an ignorant mental life. It can be accepted by him only if by the feeling, the remembrance, the dedication within it, it is turned into a movement of the spiritual consciousness and becomes a part of its vast grasp of comprehensive, illuminating knowledge. For all must be done as a sacrifice. All activities must have the one divine for their object and the heart of their meaning. This goes back to the Bhagavad Gita, 3rd chapter, Shloka 30. The yogin's aim in the sciences that make for knowledge should be to discover and understand the workings of the divine consciousness puissance in man and creatures and things and forces, her creative significances, her execution of the mysteries, the symbols in which she arranges the manifestation. The divine consciousness puissance, the Chit Shakti, Sat Chit Ananda. This is she who brings out the fullness of the Supreme in its triunity into manifold expression. The yogin's aim in the practical sciences, whether mental and physical or occult and psychic, should be to enter into the ways of the divine and his processes, to know the materials and means for the work given to us, so that we may use that knowledge for a conscious and faultless expression of the Spirit's mastery, joy, and self-fulfillment. The yogin's aim in the arts should not be a mere aesthetic, mental, or vital gratification, but seeing the divine everywhere, worshiping it with a revelation of the meaning of its own works, to express that one divine in ideal forms, the one divine in principles and forces, the one divine in gods and men and creatures and objects. Now, you know Sri Aurobindo wrote wonderful poetry, mellifluous in expression in sonnets and other types of poetry, experimenting in new meters, etc., even working in meters that go back to ancient times where quantification is how one gets the rhythm of the poetry instead of accents. Know that there were great musicians who were part of the Sri Aurobindo Ashram. Some of the best in India came to compose hymns, bhajans, dedicated to that one. There were artists who took visual media and expressed in painting and drawing what the experience of the divine meant to them, all aiming at the same thing, to give beautiful expression, to give significant form to the experience of that unique. And in the 1930s and 1940s, as materials came to them, many, many, many dozens of people in the ashram explored these artistic media in word, in music, in the visual arts, to find ways to express. Also, there were those who wrote philosophy those who probed psychology. Every field of human endeavor was made a means of exploration to see if one could reach the divine through it, or, having reached it, express it. The theory that sees an intimate connection between religious aspiration and the truest and greatest art is, in essence, right. But we must substitute for the mixed and doubtful religious motive a spiritual aspiration, vision, interpreting experience. For the wider and more comprehensive the seeing, the more it contains in itself the sense of the hidden divine in humanity and in all things, and rises beyond a superficial religiosity into the spiritual life. The more luminous, flexible, deep, and powerful will the art be that springs from that high motive. The yogin's distinction from other men is this: that he lives in a higher and vaster spiritual consciousness. All his work of knowledge or creation must then spring from there. It must not be made in the mind, for it is a greater truth and vision than mental man's that he has to express, or rather that presses to express itself through him and mold his works, not for his personal satisfaction, but for a divine purpose. Now, this was true of Sri Aurobindo's own practice of yoga from his first realization, where in that silence, that sea of silence, he could receive, as if from above, the word that was meant to be spoken. You might call it the inevitable word. And when he was writing the pages of the Arya, as he did when he was writing by hand his correspondence with his disciples, it was through a silent mind that a higher consciousness expressed itself into the receptive extensions of his hands and fingertips, which were willing servitors to that. He did not have to think. It came in masses. So later in the 40s, when Sri Aurobindo would dictate line after line after line of Savitri, this wonderful blank verse, as if he were reading from a script, Nirodh, his amanuensis, had to write hurriedly to be able to catch it all and then read it back, and Sri Aurobindo would correct and say, no, this is the word that I meant, not that. And so, with mother's example, she would sit in a silent state, and before beginning to play the organ, let her hands begin to receive the inspiration as it came from above, from a higher consciousness, and express itself without the intervention of the mind. There is an artistic mind, a level of the mind, which receives the afflatus from above and can translate, but often it diminishes the measure, the rhythm, the power of what is descending. So if you have developed an instrument which is capacious enough to receive it, flexible enough to transmit it, you don't have to suffer that diminishing. You can give it straight as it comes. This is what we do when we practice yoga. We expand the mind. We widen and make more powerful the vital. We strengthen and plasticize the body so that when that inspiration comes, it can find the right medium, which is flexible, agile, ardent, to capture and express it. For the wider and more comprehensive the seeing, the more it contains in itself the sense of the hidden divine in humanity and in all things, and rises beyond a superficial religiosity into the spiritual life. You see, we leave the human, we rise into the divine. A greater truth and vision than mental man's, not for your satisfaction, but for the divine purpose. At the same time, the yogin who knows the Supreme is not subject to any need or compulsion in these activities, for to him they are neither a duty nor a necessary occupation for the mind, nor a high amusement, nor imposed even by the loftiest human purpose. He is not attached, bound, and limited by any, nor has he any personal motive of fame, greatness, or personal satisfaction in these works. He can leave or pursue them as the divine in him wills, but he need not otherwise abandon them in his pursuit of the higher integral knowledge. He will do these things just as the supreme power acts and creates, for a certain spiritual joy in creation and expression, or to help in the holding together and right ordering or leading of this world of God's workings. Holding together of the worlds, loka sangraha. This is one of the chief concepts of the Bhagavad Gita. You'll find this in the third chapter, shloka 20 and 25. The Gita teaches that the man of knowledge shall by his way of life give to those who have not yet the spiritual consciousness the love and habit of all works, and not only of actions recognized as pious, religious, or ascetic in their character. He should not draw men away from the world action by his example. In other words, don't renounce the world, and in your shunning of life, turn others to follow your path that leads away from dynamic action. This goes back to the practice of Karma Yoga. Again, that third chapter in the Gita, the 26th shloka. For the world must proceed in its great upward aspiring. Men and nations must not be led to fall away from even an ignorant activity into a worse ignorance of inaction, or to sink down into that miserable disintegration and tendency of dissolution which comes upon communities and peoples when there predominates the tamasic principle, the principle whether of obscure confusion and error or of weariness and inertia. So if those who are the most illumined, those who practice yoga, who want to greaten consciousness in them, cease to be involved in the world and move from it because it's ugly and disfigured, they leave the field to ignorance. The reverse should happen. We should move with amplitude into the world and, if necessary, serve even in the fields of ignorance with the light of the emerging spiritual knowledge which we are graced with as we practice yoga and its fruits flow towards us. But more here. For I too, says the Lord in the Gita, have no need to do works, since there is nothing I have not or must yet gain for myself. Yet I do works in the world, for if I did not do works, all laws would fall into confusion. The worlds would sink towards chaos, and I would be the destroyer of these peoples. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, verse 22. The spiritual life does not, for its, pardon me, The spiritual life does not need for its purity to destroy interest in all things except the inexpressible, or to cut at the roots of the sciences, the arts, and life. It may well be one of the effects of an integral spiritual knowledge and activity to lift them out of their limitations. Substitute for our mind's ignorant, limited, tepid, or trepidant pleasure in them a free, intense, and uplifting urge of delight, and supply a new source of creative spiritual power and illumination by which they can be carried more swiftly and profoundly towards their absolute light in knowledge and their yet undreamed possibilities and most dynamic energy of content and form and practice. The one thing needful must be pursued first and always, but all things else come with it as its outcome, and have not so much to be added to us as recovered and reshaped in its self-light and as portions of its self-expressive force. So all things, sciences, arts, life, science, the queen of sciences is physics. And who better than Einstein to give a sense of the inherent beauty of the cosmos and its ineradicable oneness, the cosmological constant. What is true in one part of the universe must be true in all parts of the universe. And the relationship between energy and matter, between power and form, is what is always being articulated by every movement in the cosmos. And then, this reality, the one thing needful, para vidya, we must get to that supreme knowledge. We can't rest with the lower forms. How great would Einstein have been if stepping beyond his role as Vibhuti, he had become one who is a mystic knower of the cosmos and that from which the cosmos comes. He was en route. He was, in a sense, a yogin working in the field of physical science. But one must get to that. This is Sri Aurobindo's point. An integral yoga must begin there in that experience and then proceed to come back and recapture all of life, as he says here, to recover and reshape it. The self-light, that is self-illumined. Brahman, Atman, shines by its own light. So I think we pause there. We'll continue next week. Here's a section from Savitri, Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. This is roughly around page 26. As so he grew into his larger self, humanity framed his movements less and less. A greater being saw a greater world. A fearless will for knowledge dared to erase the lines of safety reason draws that bar. Minds soar, souls dive into the infinite. Even his first steps broke our small earth bounds and loitered in a vaster, freer air. In hands sustained by a transfiguring might, he caught up lightly like a giant's bow, left slumbering in a sealed and secret cave, the powers that sleep unused in man within. He made of miracle a normal act, and turned to a common part of divine works, magnificently natural at this height, efforts that would shatter the strength of mortal hearts, pursued in a royalty of mighty ease, aims too sublime for nature's daily will. The gifts of the Spirit crowding came to him. They were his life's pattern and his privilege. A pure perception lent its lucent joy. Its intimate vision waited not to think. It enveloped all nature in a single glance. It looked into the very self of things. Deceived no more by form, he saw the soul. In beings it knew what lurked to them unknown. It seized the idea in mind, the wish in the heart. It plucked out from gray folds of secrecy the motives which from their own sight men hide. He felt the beating life in other men invade him with their happiness and their grief. Their love, their anger, their unspoken hopes entered in currents or in pouring waves into the immobile ocean of his calm. He heard the inspired sound of his own thoughts re-echoed in the vault of other minds. The world's thought streams traveled into his ken. His inner self grew near to others' selves and bore a kinship's weight, a common tie, yet stood untouched, king of itself, alone. A magical accord quickened and attuned to ethereal symphonies the old earthy strings. It raised the servitors of mind and life to be happy partners in the soul's response. Tissue and nerve were turned to sensitive chords, records of luster and ecstasy. It made the body's means the spirit's acolytes. A heavenlier function with a finer mode lit with its grace man's outward earthliness. The soul's experience of its deeper sheaths no more slept, drugged by matter's dominance. In the dead wall closing us from wider self, into a secrecy of apparent sleep, the mystic tract beyond our waking thoughts, a door parted, built in by matter's force, releasing things unseized by earthly sense. A world unseen, unknown by outward mind, appeared in the silent spaces of the soul. He sat in secret chambers looking out into the luminous countries of the unborn, where all things dreamed by the mind are seen and true, and all that the life longs for is drawn close. He saw the perfect in their starry homes, wearing the glory of a deathless form, lain in the arms of the Eternal's peace, wrapped in the heartbeats of God ecstasy. He lived in the mystic space where thought is born and will is nursed by an ethereal power and fed on the white milk of the Eternal strengths, till it grows into the likeness of a god. Namaste, Jai Ma.